Hello, and welcome to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is Meet the Boleyns. The cultured charmer, the moneybags Lord Mayor, the powerful heiress, the scheming uncle. Anne's colorful family shaped the mind and character of the future Queen of England, as Tracy Borman reveals. Anne Boleyn is one of the most famous women in history. Her story has been told countless times since her tragic demise almost 500 years ago. So determined was Henry VIII to make her his queen that he wrenched England away from Roman Catholic Europe and set in train a sweeping reformation that shaped the course of British history. But when Anne failed to give him a son, he had her executed on trumped-up charges of adultery and treason in 1536. So far, so familiar. But though Anne's turbulent relationship with England's most married monarch has been pored over for centuries, her backstory is relatively unknown. What, or precisely who, made her into a woman so extraordinarily captivating that she held a king in thrall for 7 long years and turned his entire kingdom upside down? Humble roots. Though they rose to become one of the most powerful families in Tudor England, the Boleyns could boast neither royal blood nor aristocratic pedigree. They were likely of northern French descent, among numerous Norman families to settle in England after the conquest of 1066. The first known reference to the family is found in the deed for a small plot of land close to Norwich in 1188. The Boleyns remained in Norfolk for the next 3 centuries, where they made their living from the wool trade. It was Geoffrey Boleyn, 1406 to 1463, Anne's great-grandfather, who put the family on the map. He made a small fortune from his work as a hatter and was appointed Master of the Worship Company of Mercers. By 1451, he was so wealthy that he loaned Henry VI money for an expedition to France. 6 years later, he was elected Lord Mayor of London. To signal his prestige, Geoffrey purchased several properties, including the manors of Blickling in North Norfolk and Hever in Kent. Geoffrey's son William propelled the Boleyns into royal circles when he entered the service of Richard III, who made him a Knight of the Bath at his coronation in 1483. William also made an advantageous marriage to Margaret Butler, daughter and co-heiress of the 7th Earl of Ormond, a prominent Irish nobleman. With a deftness that characterized the Boleyns' rise to power, when Richard III was defeated by Henry Tudor at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, William declared his allegiance to the new king. William also invested heavily in the education of his eldest son and heir, Thomas. Aged about 8 when Henry VII took the throne, Thomas grew into a charming and cultured young man who soon won favor at court. Upon the death of his father in 1505, he became the head of the family and led the Boleyns to the apogee of their power. At Henry VIII's accession in 1509, he was created a Knight of the Garter and an esquire of the new king's privy chamber. By then, Thomas was married with a growing family. Like his father, he had chosen a high-ranking bride. Elizabeth Howard was the eldest daughter of Thomas Howard, later the 2nd Duke of Norfolk, and he was appointed to serve Catherine of Aragon, the widow of Prince Arthur, whom Henry had married soon after becoming king. "She brought me every year a child," Thomas said of Elizabeth, though only 3 survived to adulthood: Mary, Anne, and George. 2 small brass crosses mark the burial places of Henry and Thomas Boleyn, Jr., one in the church next to Hever, the other close to Penshurst Place, the seat of Thomas Boleyn's rival, Edward Stafford, 3rd Duke of Buckingham. It's thought that Thomas Jr. may have been sent to Penshurst to receive an education. There is no other record of the two boys or Anne's relationship with her lost brothers, assuming she knew them at all. The size of the crosses suggests they died in their infancy, a reminder of the fragility of life in Tudor England. The Boleyn children were raised at Blicking Hall and Hever Castle, though the latter soon became the principal family seat. Judging from the date of his first appearance at court around 1514, George seems to have been the youngest, and Mary was later referred to as the elder of the two daughters, though their birth dates are unclear. It was not clear how much time Anne spent with her mother, but they are thought to have been close. Elizabeth would have superintended her children's early education, juggling that with her service at court. There was a rumor that Elizabeth was briefly the mistress of Henry VIII, but this was not substantiated by any reliable evidence, and Henry himself later denied it, exclaiming, "Never with the mother." From a young age, Anne and Mary were schooled in the accomplishments expected of young women at the time, including music and dancing, embroidery, and religion. They were also taught literature and languages, by the latter being something in which Anne excelled. Her father proudly noted that she was exceptionally toward. Thomas played an important role in Anne's education, and his humanist beliefs may have influenced her curriculum. He was a progressive thinker and espoused the emerging fashion for educating daughters, not just sons, as famously advocated by his fellow courtiers Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell. Dazzling opportunity. In 1513, when Anne was probably around 12 years old, her father secured her a dazzling opportunity. She was sent to the Palace of Mechlin in Brabant, a region now spanning parts of Belgium and the Netherlands, to join the court of Margaret of Austria, regent of the Netherlands. It was an education like no other, and profoundly shaped Anne's outlook, accomplishments, and intellect. Her new mistress was a woman who wielded real power in a male-dominated world. Years later, when a queen-in-waiting, Anne, remodeled York Place in London on Margaret's palace, creating a palace at Whitehall. Anne remained in close contact with the household at Hever throughout her years abroad. A letter she wrote to her father in around 1514 still survives. As well as showing off her new mastery of French, she assured Thomas that absence had made her heart grow fonder. "I promise you that my love is based on such great strength that it will never grow less." Joining Margaret's court at a young age, Anne's mind was greatly shaped by the influential, powerful older woman. Anne's courtly training continued when her father arranged for her to serve in the French court with her sister. While Mary enjoyed the glittering social life and is rumored to have become a mistress of King Francis I, Anne preferred the company of his sister, Marguerite of Navarre. An intellectual powerhouse, Marguerite argued for the reform of the Catholic Church and was a fierce advocate for female authority. The teenaged Anne soaked all this up like a sponge. By the time she left France in 1521, she was a changed young woman. Back at Hever, another Margaret exerted a profound influence on Anne, her parental grandmother, Lady Margaret Butler. Hers was one of the most powerful noble families in Ireland, and Margaret inherited considerable estates upon the death of her father, the 7th Earl of Ormond, in 1515. She was thus a rare example of a wealthy and independent woman in an age dominated by men. 4 years after coming into her inheritance, though, Margaret was suddenly declared insane and deprived of her lands. Whether she was really suffering from a mental illness or perhaps dementia, by then she was aged about 65, is uncertain. Either way, it served as a salutary reminder to Anne of just how precarious a woman's position could be. Anne was also influenced by her elder sister, Mary, albeit as an example of what not to do. Returning from France sometime before Anne, Mary took up a position in the household of Catherine of Aragon. In 1520, she married William Carey, a gentleman of Henry VIII's privy chamber, but around that time, she almost certainly began an affair with the king. It isn't clear how long their liaison lasted, but Henry was rumored to have been the father of at least one of Mary's children. He neither acknowledged this nor made any provision for Mary once the affair ended. She was simply discarded, her reputation in ruins. It was a lesson Anne never forgot. A shock proposal. Anne made her debut at the English court early in 1522, after her father secured her a place in Queen Catherine's household. This exotic arrival from the French court was soon the talk of London. Her intellect, accomplishments, and style made the other ladies of Henry's court appear positively pedestrian. She danced and sang better than any of them, and though not conventionally beautiful, her charisma and self-confidence quickly attracted a legion of male admirers. Anne's self-serving uncle, Thomas Howard, later Duke of Norfolk, tried to engineer a marriage with James Butler, her cousin and heir to the Earl of Ormond, which prompted the first in a series of clashes with his niece. Norfolk later ranted that Anne would be the ruin of her whole family. When it came to the Boleyns, blood wasn't always thicker than water. At least initially, the king himself appeared immune to Anne's charms, and it was not until 1526 that he declared his interest in her. It was at this time that Hever Castle became Anne's refuge. Contrary to the popular image of her father as a grasping courtier who pushed her into the king's path to further his own ambitions, the evidence suggests that Thomas tried to protect Anne from Henry's advances. Whether his loyal master became too overbearing, he arranged for his younger daughter to seek sanctuary at the family home. But the more Anne retreated to Hever, the more determinedly Henry pursued her. When Anne went to stay at Hever for Christmas in 1526, she received a letter from the king. It was very different from his usual billets. Astonishingly, he proposed marriage. This must have sent shockwaves through the castle. Henry already had a wife, one who was greatly revered throughout England, but he claimed that his marriage to Catherine was unlawful and had been cursed by God, as evidenced by the fact that they had no living son. Henry spent the next 7 years trying to convince Pope Clement VII to grant an annulment of his marriage. For much of this time, Anne flitted between the court and Hever. She was attended by both her mother and her sister-in-law, Jane, who married George Boleyn around 1524. By contrast, Anne saw little of her sister Mary and later banished her from court for marrying William Stafford, a lowly soldier, claiming that it had brought disgrace on the Boleyns. Source of solace. George was a constant source of solace and companionship to Anne. Like his father, he was a favorite of the king and rose rapidly through the ranks once his sister had caught Henry's eye. George shared Anne's reformist views, and they both imported radical religious texts from abroad that might have had them condemned as heretics. Supported by her brother, Anne brought her influence to bear on Henry, persuading him that a king should be subject to no authority but God's, a view that made the Pope an irrelevance. Henry had the justification he needed to break with Rome and push through the annulment. In January 1533, he married Anne in a secret ceremony at Whitehall. Eustace Chapuis, ambassador to England from the Holy Roman Empire and a prolific letter writer, claimed that both her parents were in attendance. You've been listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Next up, we're drawn to visions of perfect female monarchs. It's almost as if we prefer the image of a queen to the reality of a flesh and blood woman. Kate Williams speaks to Charlotte Vosper about the changing image of female monarchs and why we expect too much of them. Regina, A New History of Women and Power by Kate Williams, published by Wendenfeld and Nicholson. Charlotte Vosper, your new book challenges the myths and stereotypes that have depicted queens as evil, mad, or just not up to the job. How did you decide which women to include? Kate Williams, it was a tough decision. I could have written volume after volume. I wanted to pick out queens who have been characterized as iconic failures or successes and to analyze these depictions. So we have everyone from Hatshepsut to Mary I, from Boudica to Grace of Monaco. And I noticed trends and patterns appearing. For example, lots of queens such as Marie Antoinette and Cleopatra are characterized as being led by their emotions and unable to manage money. Many were sexualized and romanticized, again including Cleopatra, but also Anne Boleyn. Of course, we must recognize that these women were privileged beyond measure, but I think that their reputations are emblematic of the stories told about all women through time. If we think that queens are failures, then what does that do to perceptions of ordinary women? You might suggest that there's no connection between what we say about someone like Anne Boleyn and whether we'll ever have a female U.S. president. But I think that the narratives we weave about the most celebrated women impact all of us. Question. You open the book by discussing the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut, one of the earliest female rulers. With no blueprint for queenship, how did she go about legitimizing her rule? Hatshepsut ruled from circa 1473 to 1458 BC, and she was expected to live as the king's daughter and the consort of another king, then to become a king's stepmother. Those roles would have given a woman quite a lot of power in the court of ancient Egypt, yet Hatshepsut vaulted her status as stepmother to become a pharaoh herself. She transformed her role as a regent into one of a female king by pushing her stepson out of the way and claiming her legitimacy as the heir to her father. She then created a whole iconography to make the point that she was always destined to be monarch. We can see this in her incredible Mansion of a Million Years in Luxor, where her story is carved into the walls. These reliefs show her born as a boy and growing into a ruler wearing the dress of a male monarch. This iconography completely excludes images of her as a daughter, a high priestess, or a consort, even though these female roles had been very important to her rise of power. Question. You mention her male dress. Was Hatshepsut bending gender norms, or was she using the only language of power available at the time? Answer. I think Hatshepsut saw herself as beyond gender, as transcending the bounds of femininity and embodying both genders. In Egyptian mythology, when you died, you became transcendent of gender, which is actually common in a lot of religions and mythologies. In the case of Hatshepsut, fashioning herself as a king, Egyptian mortuary beliefs. Over and over again throughout history, being similar to a man was congratulated. For example, Napoleon reported that Marie Therese, daughter of Marie Antoinette, was the only man in her family. Meanwhile, Elizabeth I claimed to have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but the stomach and heart of a king. These figures raise the question of how a queen could be both a woman and a monarch. In Hatshepsut's case, that combination created a real problem for her descendants. Images of her as a female king were scraped off the walls of her temples. Luckily for us, though, it was done in a pretty shoddy way. So by the 19th century, European explorers found themselves looking at carvings of an Egyptian king who was referred to with female pronouns. Question. What type of queens emerged in the early Middle Ages? Answer. What we start to see are great periods of female kingship, because when societies are in transition, female monarchs start appearing. It may be because all the men have died in battle, and people think, well, there's no one left. Let's have a woman on the throne. But certainly from the 5th and 10th centuries, when lots of small kingdoms formed into larger empires, more queens took power. For example, you might think that the chrysanthemum throne in Japan has always been occupied solely by men. But several women reigned during this period, from Empress Suiko, 593 to 628, to Empress Koken, 749 to 58, and 764 to 70. They were powerful, admired, and beloved, ruling not just because there was no one else, but as chosen monarchs. Moving into the later medieval period, one of my favorite monarchs in the 14th century was Sultana Khadija of the Maldives. A traveler to the archipelago at the time wrote that one of the great wonders is a female monarch called Khadija. Little remains of her palace or archives today, but we do know that she bumped off her brother to take the throne. She then got married, perhaps because she felt she had to continue her line. But when her husband got too keen on power, she bumped him off too. She married again, but her second husband also became too power hungry, so she had him killed and ruled alone. In general, however, there was a decline in female monarchs over the course of the medieval period. After 900, though there were many queen consorts, fewer queen regnants ruled themselves. It wasn't until the 16th century that a period of unprecedented levels of queenship arrived. Question: among the most famous queens of the 16th century are Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. How should we understand their roles and relationship? Answer: Catherine and Anne were often compared with each other. One is dowdy and one is glamorous. To me, though, these women show us that in the 16th century, kings were beginning to grapple with the question of the role of the queen consort. During that century, the consort was really unassailable, and that became a problem for Henry VIII when he wanted to marry Anne. He couldn't simply say, "Oh, can I have another wife?" He had to get rid of Catherine entirely to justify his marriage to Anne. Catherine, however, would not be set aside easily, and Henry punished her for it. She was prevented from seeing her child, Mary, and was sent away from court, plunging her into an impossible limbo. When Henry later wanted to set aside Anne Boleyn, he realized that he couldn't do so on the same grounds as with his marriage to Catherine, which was annulled on the basis that she had been previously married to Henry's elder brother, Arthur. So Anne had to be killed in a political assassination, based on trumped-up evidence supposedly showing that she had sex with man after man. Henry wanted to characterize her as a wild seductress, a sinful woman, and that idea has stuck. But I think we should view Henry's treatment of Catherine and Anne as evidence that male monarchs felt that female consorts had too much power in the 16th century. We should focus on how difficult it was for Henry to dislodge Catherine and Anne rather than viewing the women themselves as rivals. Isn't it the greatest irony that Henry turned the world upside down to remarry and have a son, yet who is often seen as the greatest Tudor? Elizabeth I. Question: which other queens have been saddled with unfair reputations? Answer: Mary I is another whose reputation has been unfairly tarnished. Yes, she burned around 280 people, but though that was incredibly brutal, her relatives killed many more people. Holinshed's Chronicles, published 1577 and 1587, estimate that Henry VIII had 72,000 people executed across his reign. During his half-brother Edward VI's time on the throne, approximately 5,500 people died in the Prayer Book Rebellion. Elizabeth executed many people too. Yet Mary is the one labeled bloody. Actually, I think she was the most merciful of the Tudors. So why has this bloody notion stayed with us all these years? Partly it's because Protestants were writing history in Elizabeth I's reign, castigating and criticizing Mary as a way of vaulting and praising Elizabeth. There's something particularly cruel in the name Bloody Mary. It brings to mind the association between women and menstrual blood, and though Mary tried so hard to have a child, she never did. In her short reign, Mary laid down the roadmap for Elizabeth's rule. Yet it was during Elizabeth's reign that Mary was declared terrible. We see that again in extreme with Marie Antoinette, who became a human shooting target for those who saw a problem with the luxurious life of the French monarchy. Yes, the court in Versailles spent a lot of money, and so did Marie, but it was nothing compared with the French military spending in support of the American War of Independence against Britain. The French were also operating within an archaic taxation collection system, which led to unrest. Despite these contributing factors, after the French Revolution, Marie Antoinette was blamed for everything. And we should remember that during the 18th century, a queen was supposed to display wealth and symbolize excellence. Marie Antoinette tried to portray herself in this way, and for this she was turned into a monster. Marie Antoinette was executed in 1793, as was her husband, Louis XVI. But if the French deemed monarchy to be so terrible, why did they not kill the heirs to the throne? Marie's young son, Louis Charles, became a workman's apprentice while still imprisoned, and the king's brothers fled. Clearly, the queen consort, the woman who had no blood right to the throne, was seen as more symbolic of the horrors and disaster of monarchy than the monarchy itself. Question: the 19th century brought the age of empire and constitutional monarchy. How was the queenship used to sell imperial power? Answer: in Britain, Victoria spun an image of the perfect domestic wife and mother with a vengeance, and the British public lapped it up. From the image of the Queen and Albert in 1848 with a Christmas tree, to Highland Leaves, her best-selling Scottish travel journal. But this vision of happy domesticity wasn't her reality. She and Albert were always arguing, and Victoria was bent on keeping her power for herself. The image of Victoria as the perfect domestic queen was used across the British Empire to justify takeovers. For example, Queen Ravavalona I of Madagascar was given Victoria's image by British envoys and essentially told, "Can't you be more like Victoria?" They compared Ravavalona's military effort to protect her country's sovereignty and her expulsion of British missionaries with the popular image of Victoria, of domestic, submissive, constitutional queenship. Of course, they were really asking the Queen of Madagascar to become more subservient and more Christian, more receptive to European colonial influence. The image of Victoria's queenship was used frequently to bolster imperial ventures. Frederick Hodgson, governor of the British colony of the Gold Coast in what's now Ghana, wanted to take the sacred golden stool from the Asante people. In justification, he claimed that he would be taking it for the queen. Of course, Victoria knew nothing about the stool, but it's an example of how the idea of British as the ultimate ruler, with Victoria at the top of the tree, was used to justify the seizure of power from other monarchs and people across the empire. Question: how did the expectations of queenship evolve during the 20th century? Answer: Grace Kelly is emblematic of the new type of queenship seen in the 20th century, televisual queenship. Before she became Princess of Monaco, few Americans, and not many overall, knew where Monaco was. This tiny principality, smaller than Central Park. But the country was in serious debt after the Second World War, so Prince Rainier wanted to put the place on the map. He did so by marrying an American movie star. Grace Kelly had first been an advertising model, selling things such as household bug spray. But by the time she met Rainier, she was a successful Hollywood actress. About a year after meeting, they got married, and it was a huge media event. She described how, when she walked into the Cathedral of Monaco on her wedding day, she saw cameras everywhere, hidden in the flower arrangements. She looked so serene in the wedding footage, which sold the image of her as a fairy tale princess worldwide, putting Monaco on the global stage. But this fairy tale wasn't her reality. At a party in 1981, Princess Grace met Lady Diana Spencer in the powder room. Diana, then engaged to Prince Charles, was upset that she'd worn the wrong dress for the occasion. Grace warned Diana that the scrutiny was only going to get worse. Kate Williams is a historian, broadcaster, and author, and professor in public engagement with history at the University of Reading. You've been listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is classical Royal British music by D'Lo Sound. If you miss a program, you can always get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode. Thank you.